you know, when we have less data, we get more conservative because we're going to err on the side of the fish. And so that's likely to happen.
State agencies like the DNR prepare for a partial government shutdown. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, June 3rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a healthcare worker on a mission to convince Alaskans to sign advance directives.
Like this morning, I said in my office, okay, so you guys, this is my mission. Do you have your advance directives? And 75% did not.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
And by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Between the regular session, the extended session, and now two special sessions, the legislature has been meeting for 135 days. But even with all the extra time, lawmakers appear no closer to a budget deal than they were a month ago. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez covers the legislature and joins us to talk about the impasse. Hello, Alexandra.
Hi, Lori.
Today, a group of select lawmakers were scheduled to meet in a conference committee to hammer out budget differences. What happened?
Basically, legislators spent the meeting complaining about how the legislature is terrible, how there's gridlock, how the state's fiscal situation is lousy, how they haven't seen their families, and how they are generally cranky. It was sort of funny, given that, well, as legislators, they actually have the power to make the legislature not terrible. The co-chair of the House Finance Committee, Mark Newman, who is a Republican from Big Lake, also announced that they're basically starting over. On Friday, a deal had been reached between House Republicans and Democrats on the budget. Democrats would support a withdrawal from the state's rainy day fund on the conditions that extra money be added to education, that the ferry system get a little more funding, and that raises negotiated by the state employee unions be honored. The last point was a sticking point for the Senate, so they torpedoed the deal. So now it's just as much of a mess as it ever was.
Is there any end in sight?
Optimists would like to think so, but now that layoff notices have gone out to 10,000 state employees, there's less pressure to actually get a resolution in a timely fashion. There are no meetings or floor sessions scheduled until Friday, so there's no expectation that things are going to somehow turn around in the next 48 hours. The next real deadline is the actual day of a partial government shutdown on July 1st. If this is any indicator, last week, lawmakers were told not to leave Anchorage in case a deal was reached and their vote was needed. Now, even key players like House Finance Co-Chair Steve Thompson are flying home, to Fairbanks in his case, to tend to family stuff and deal with their personal lives. I actually did some of the same over the weekend and went to D.C., and my first thought when coming back to Alaska was that Washington looks more functional right now.
Alexandra, it seems that some legislators are even apologizing to constituents for what's happening.
Yes, Representative Jonathan Christ Tompkins, a Democrat from Sitka, sent out a constituent newsletter today where the subject line was simply, ugh. He opened by saying, on behalf of the entire legislative branch, I am so sorry. And then he made a case for compromise. He also wrote about the damage caused to state workers, to the state's credit rating, and to the state's economy if things really do shut down.
The budget isn't the only thing the legislature is considering in this special session. Has there been any movement on the Alaska Safe Children's Act, or Aaron's Law, as it's known across the country?
Since the Senate Education Committee rewrote it in a pretty controversial way 2 weeks ago, there has not been a single hearing on it. Some lawmakers say that there's been behind-the-scenes work to restore it to something closer to its original version, which would require schools to offer sexual abuse and dating violence prevention programs. They want to take out other bills that have been glommed onto it that deal with standardized testing and banning schools from contracting with Planned Parenthood on anything health-related. Some also have a perspective that the legislature should deal with the budget first and then with this. Even so, it's striking that this is the only other thing on the legislature's plate, and it's a pretty simple thing. And even then, it hasn't gone anywhere.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us, Alexandra.
Thank you, Lori.
That was APRN's Capitol correspondent, Alexandra Gutierrez. With a partial government shutdown looming, state agencies are making plans for what services might be reduced without a budget deal by July 1st. But salmon don't care about budgets and money. The fish are coming to Alaska waters whether or not the Department of Fish and Game will have its usual resources to manage them. Margaret Friedenauer of KHNS reports.
Commercial fishermen in Haines are readying their gillnet boats for the upcoming salmon season. They have about 3 weeks before their first opener in the Lynn Canal. That's about the same amount of time legislators have to approve a state operating budget before thousands of state employees face layoffs and many state departments face a partial shutdown. That includes the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. They count the fish and tell fishermen when and where they can operate. Cindy Adams captains the Lady Hawk. She says the budget uncertainty is not coming at an ideal time for the commercial fishing season.
That's a problem. I mean, a big problem for us because we have a finite time to make our money. And if that gets compromised in any way, then our season, you know, is compromised.
Fishermen are ready. You know, everybody is just ready to go. And so we'll do our best to make sure they have that opportunity.
That's Jeff Regnart, director of the Division of Commercial Fisheries for Fish and Game. He says if a budget isn't passed by July 1st, ADF&G will have to operate with about 70% less money than usual. He says the department won't stop commercial fishing, but the management of those fisheries could be more conservative than usual. For example, the fleet could get less time to fish in a certain area. That's because survey and research programs might suffer and biologists won't have as much data to make management decisions.
You know, when we have less data, we get more conservative because we're going to err on the side of the fish. And so that's likely to happen if we're continuing to operate under this fiscal umbrella that we have. You know, we'll do our best to make sure that it doesn't impact things substantially. That's really the key for us, is to make sure we can maintain the escapement, maintain the priority uses, healthy fisheries. That's our hope.
By July 1st, several fisheries will be underway across the state. In Southeast, those include salmon purse seine, gillnet, and troll fisheries. But Regnart says ADF&G has its priorities. First is the conservation of fish stocks. Second to that is managing for subsistence use.
Commercial fishing follows that subsistence use as a priority, and so we'll do our best to make sure those fisheries have an opportunity to harvest salmon. We hope that they can harvest it close to what they would have if we would have been funded, you know, if it would have been a, quote, normal year.
Unlike a normal year, Regnart says most forecasts predict near record levels of salmon returns across the state. The threat of a government shutdown is not stopping the fleet in Haines from getting ready for business as usual. Across the harbor from Adams is fisherman Bill Thomas. He thinks a more conservatively managed fishery isn't a bad thing.
You know, we've fished 12-hour openings in the past to conserve for fish.
Thomas has firsthand experience with the legislature. He's a former state representative, and he says a month is still plenty of time to forge a budget deal.
I think they'll have a budget by then. I think, you know, what's the old saying? You have nothing to fear but fear itself. You know, we don't need to panic yet.
Instead of worrying about what could happen to state government, Thomas will spend those 3 weeks gearing up for salmon season. Reporting in Haines, I'm Margaret Friedenauer.
Ketchikan Independent Representative Dan Ortez faces up to $6,000 in fines for campaign violations. The Alaska Public Offices Commission says he failed to properly report some campaign contributions and spending. It also says he accepted an illegal donation and did not state who paid for several campaign flyers. Ortez admits making mistakes.
They were errors purely out of omission, not commission. You know, it wasn't anything that was planned, wasn't anything that, you know, was something that in any way benefited my campaign or anything like that.
Complaints were filed by his Republican opponent, Sherry Klein, and the district's Republican Party organization. Ortez won the election by 104 votes. He challenges some of the allegations in the complaints while admitting others. The fines could have been far higher, but staff took into account his status as a first-time legislative candidate, as well as his cooperation.
You know, it is what it is, and I'm just looking forward to making my case in front of the commission, and whatever the decision is, I'll live with it.
The violations and fines were on the agenda for a Public Offices Commission meeting today, but complaints cannot be heard during a legislative session, so the issue was pushed back to the next meeting in September. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, foraging for your salad or stir fry in the urban wilds.
I kind of relish the sting because it's a reminder that spring is here.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Many Alaskans who die in boating accidents don't die of hypothermia. Without a life jacket, drowning kills long before hypothermia does. More at pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Talking about death is never easy, but it's especially difficult in a hospital when a loved one is incapacitated and family members are trying to guess their wishes. Two healthcare workers in Anchorage want to convince Alaskans to have that conversation before a crisis and record their choices in an advance directive. APRN's Annie Feit has the story.
I had known Gigi Rigg for all of about 20 minutes when she brought up the subject of advance directives. To be fair, I was interviewing her for a related story, and Rigg found a way to casually fold it into the conversation. She had also hit on the topic with her coworkers earlier that day.
Like this morning, I said in my office, okay, so you guys, this is my mission. Do you have your advance directives? If I want 100% of the people I'm seeing to have them, my coworkers should have them. And 75% did not.
Rigg is a medical social worker at Alaska Innovative Medicine. The new group helps patients with complex problems navigate the medical system to improve their care. Rigg counsels patients in their homes to help them stay on track meeting their healthcare goals. And she always tries to bring up the topic of advance directives with patients and their families.
And I bring advance directives for both partners. Or the daughter, and they're kind of thrown off by that. Like, whoa, wait, that's just for my dad, or that's for my husband. And it's like everybody, I really believe everybody needs a healthcare agent that knows what they want.
Before Alaska Innovative Medicine, Rigg was a social worker at Alaska Regional Hospital. In that job, she saw too many patients in medical crisis, unable to speak for themselves. Rigg says family members often didn't know what the patient wanted or disagreed about their wishes.
And their voice wasn't at the table when the family was talking to the doctors. And that makes me sad that the person that is being talked about should have a way to be at that table, whether they're physically present or not.
An advance directive puts you at the table. It's a legal document that spells out what type of life-saving measures you want doctors to take if you're in a coma or suffer severe brain damage or are close to death and not expected to recover. Advance directives also ask you to appoint a healthcare agent, someone who knows your wishes and will be the person speaking on your behalf if you can't. Chris Green is the Advanced Care Planning Coordinator at Providence Health Systems in Anchorage. She has a 2-year grant to try to convince more Alaskans to sign advance directives.
My job is to get the word out, to educate the general public that these forms exist and how to have that conversation. Because this is tough stuff. People don't want to talk about death and dying. They don't. And yet it's critically important because it can happen on a nanosecond.
Green knows from experience. 10 years ago, her husband, Michael Scheib, was working to set up a large dining tent at a Boy Scout jamboree in Virginia. As Scheib helped guide the tent center pole into place, he was electrocuted, along with 3 other scout leaders. Scheib was 49 years old. He and Green had signed advance directives earlier that year when they were drawing up their wills. Scheib died instantly, but because they had had the conversation, Green knew her husband wouldn't have wanted heroic life-saving measures. She also knew what kind of funeral arrangements to make.
This plan in place is a gift to family members because the most important or difficult piece of all of this is families are struggling when there is an accident and people haven't had those conversations. What should we do? And then left with bad feelings and just horror at having to make a decision at a very difficult time.
The state of Alaska recognizes two types of advance directives. One is a formal-looking legal document provided by Alaska Legal Services. Green says for people new to the conversation, a form called Five Wishes is an easier place to start. Green also recommends getting advice from an expert. She's developing workshops to provide that advice and is recruiting volunteers to help. In the end, Green and Gigi Rigg at AIM don't care which document Alaskans use as long as they tell their loved ones their preferences and identify a healthcare agent. The last essential step, signing the advance directive. And of course, Rigg doesn't let me leave our interview without asking the question.
Do you have one?
No, I don't have one.
See, so we should do yours before you go.
Okay.
See, and it makes people uncomfortable. Like, you're getting red. It's like, what does that mean? What?
Rigg runs into her office, grabs the forms, and tells me she will personally notarize them when I'm ready. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
The Alaska Department of Transportation plans to reopen the flood-damaged northern stretch of the Dalton Highway to traffic on Friday morning. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the opening will follow a nearly three-week closure caused by melt of unusually heavy overflow ice from the Sag River.
Alaska Department of Transportation Northern Region Director Dave Miller says erosion repairs between Dalton Highway milepost 356 and 414 south of Dead Horse have progressed well since water levels began dropping late last week.
You know, we can get a pickup from one end to the other now, which we couldn't before. So they pioneered in a goat trail.
Miller provided an update on the Dalton status during a presentation to the Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation Tuesday, describing an all-out assault by contractors working to open the highway.
Well, there's probably 45 trucks running right now hauling gravel, you know, multiple excavators, multiple bulldozers.
Miller adds that some flood damage is requiring special attention, including an exposed pipeline crossing at mile 399.
It's going to take Alyeska probably 2 weeks before they'll be ready for traffic to go back on that. So we're putting a bypass in around that area.
The flood repairs will be followed by planned and expanded projects to elevate portions of the Dalton Highway. The projects originally designed to reduce snow drifting will also help keep the road surface above overflow ice and flooding. Miller attributes this year's trouble to heavy rains that fell last fall on the Brooks Range, elevating groundwater levels dramatically along the Dalton Highway Trans-Alaska Pipeline Corridor.
Normally the meter at pump 3 reads 10 cubic feet per second, and in early March it was reading 220 cubic feet per second. So we had, you know, a lot more water moving.
Miller adds that when the Sag River froze to the bottom this winter, off ice began rapidly accumulating, engulfing the Dalton Highway, which parallels the river. He says it's unclear how unique an event it was, but DOT won't wait to find out.
We've accelerated everything we can do to not be in this situation again next year.
The Dalton Highway is a primary supply conduit for the North Slope oil industry, but Miller says the latest closure has not been a big problem for them because it was after oil companies had gotten through the busy season of moving equipment and supplies related to ice road accessed field sites, and because the Dalton closure was anticipated and the companies stocked up on fuel and other supplies before breakup flooding shut down the road. This spring's emergency Dalton Highway repairs have already cost $5 million. Miller says most of the repair bill will likely be picked up by the federal government. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Raven Alaska, providing business travel needs in over 100 communities across the state. Find more at flyraven.com. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
Looking for salad ingredients or want a new type of tea? No need to head to the store. Just look outside your door, even if you live in the middle of the city. Some Anchorage residents are urban gatherers. KSKA's Ann Hillman went out to check on a free-range garden.
Matthew Lohr rides his bike up the Chester Creek Trail in midtown Anchorage and pulls off to the side, not far from a busy road.
So this is a spot I go to in the spring a lot. And it's kind of fun because when you're staying on the trail, you really don't notice that there's a lot of nettles here. But once you start walking in it, see all underneath here, this is all nettle. The whole place is going to be nettles.
He bends down and starts plucking off the top two tender leaves with his bare hands, despite the fact that stinging nettles, well, sting.
I kind of relish the sting because it's a reminder that spring is here.
The fuzzy, jagged-edged leaves fill his bag. Lohr's getting enough for the evening stir-fry and some extras to dry for the upcoming winter. He says gathering is a fun way to stay engaged with the environment and provide friends with healthy local foods. Lohr is an urban gatherer, one of the people you see on the side of the trail with grocery sacks filled with dandelion greens, fiddlehead ferns, fireweed shoots, and even Devil's Club. Michelle Wilbur is another.
Everybody knows Devil's Club, right? You're not going to mistake Devil's Club. And in the early spring, you go out and you see these big, spiky stalks coming up, and you're like, there would never be anything you'd want to eat about that. And the name makes you think that it would be ultimately poisonous.
Wilbur leads wild edible walks for Alaska Community Action on Toxics and gathers for her own family.
But the new little shoots, when they first come out, the spines are furry instead of spiny at the very beginning. And so you need to get them really early. It's way too late right now to pick Devil's Club.
So she hands me a furry shoot picked a few days before, the last of the season.
And it's a strong flavor, too.
It reminds me of, like, really bitter carrots.
Yes.
On the grass, Wilbur displays a wild harvested salad bar. The greens are lemony and sharp or bitter or nutty. Wilbur says they're loaded with nutrients and grow everywhere. You just need a knowledgeable friend or a guidebook to make sure you're gathering the right ones.
Every year when I'm putting in these annual gardens and then I'm going out and harvesting all these nettles that are nobody's tending and there's huge plots of them, I'm like, why? Why don't I just harvest nettles instead of babying these little broccoli starts along? But they're both good.
Wilbur emphasizes you need to be aware of your surroundings when you harvest. Don't clear out an area. Just pick a few so the plants can grow back. And make sure the plants you're picking haven't been sprayed with herbicides or pesticides. Tim Stallard is the Invasive Plant Program Coordinator with the Anchorage Park Foundation. He says herbicides are used sparingly in the city's parks to kill things like the invasive bird cherry.
Yeah, the bird cherry, it's kind of like the, you know, Medusa, where you cut off its head and it'll grow like 10 more. If you just cut it down, the stump will sprout, and then the roots themselves can sprout up to 30 feet away.
So they apply herbicides directly to the stumps. They also do limited spraying for Canada thistle when necessary. For larger projects, they get approval from community councils first and always post signs to let people know about the chemicals. But Stellart says people gathering food need to use common sense.
If you go in an area and see dead plants or damaged plants, you know, obviously something's not right, and that something's not right should trigger in their mind, and you wouldn't want to gather plants in that area.
Back on the Chester Creek Trail, Lohr digs his fingers into the soil to harvest a dandelion root.
So this isn't that big. If it's looser soil, you'll get, I've found that I get bigger roots.
When he gathers enough, he'll dry them, grind them, and make a hot tea-like beverage. But for now, he tears off a leaf and starts eating. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
When an eagle dies in Alaska, its feathers may end up in a powwow or on a graduation cap somewhere in the lower 48. That's because of a federal program connecting tribes, raptor centers, and wildlife officials. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
One, two, three.
No questions.
There we go.
A bald eagle is released into the wild at the Alaska Raptor Center in Sitka. It's one of hundreds treated for injuries, disease, or malnourishment at centers around the state. But the story doesn't end with the flight. That's because the Raptor Center collects feathers rehabilitating birds lose while molting.
Usually that happens kind of towards the end of summer.
Jennifer Cedarleaf is rehabilitation coordinator at the Sitka Center. It collects eagle carcasses as well as shed plumage from residents and rehabbees.
Our education birds that are here year-round, when they drop their feathers, we collect those, and they all just get saved up, and then I can send them down there.
There is the National Eagle Repository, run by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service near Denver, Colorado. Only Alaska Natives and American Indians are allowed to gather, store, and use feathers or parts from eagles and some other protected birds, with a couple exceptions. If the plumage or parts aren't available locally, the repository helps.
So it could be for folks that are in a powwow, dancing, fans, bustles.
Joseph Early is the Native American liaison for the Wildlife Service's Southwest Region and a Laguna Pueblo member.
We have some of our tribes that use them for our very sacred ceremonies, naming ceremonies, birth ceremonies, sometimes for funerals, graduations. So it basically comes down to the individual member to be able to utilize the feather for however they want to.
Early discussed the program during the recent Native American Fish and Wildlife Society convention in Juneau. He shared reports showing Alaska provided about 10% of the feathers, parts, or whole eagle carcasses sent to the repository last year. But tribal members here only took about 0.5% of what was distributed.
Eagles are fairly abundant up here, of course, but we have some tribes maybe up here that want golden eagle, which is a little more abundant in the lower 48, so we're trying to accommodate any tribes for what they want.
Tribes and members cannot give or sell eagle carcasses, feathers, or parts to non-native people. In addition to live birds, the Alaska Raptor Center collects carcasses for shipment to the federal repository. Cedarleaf says one particularly bad year, more than 70 were tagged, frozen, and mailed south.
It is sad when you find a beautiful bird dead, and for us it's even more sad when we find one that's banded that we knew. Like I had one that hit a power line just a few weeks ago that we had when it was a baby. And that makes it more difficult.
She says knowing the carcasses will find a new use makes it a little easier. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Margaret Friedenauer in Haines, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ann Hillman in Anchorage. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
And by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. APU is still accepting applications for fall 2015. Find out about financial aid and the promised tuition grant and apply online at alaskapacific.edu before Saturday, August 1st. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.